he's just, I don't know, man. He's just so cool. What's today? It's Eclipse Day. That's what it is. Eric. It's Eclipse Day. It's August 21st, the day of the eclipse. So depending on when you're listening, it may have already happened, or it may have been a cosmic sign and the world has come to an end, in which case you can't listen. But then you wouldn't know that you can't listen because you wouldn't be able to hear what I'm saying because the world has indeed ended.
Deep.
It's a paradox, right?
It's supposed to be mostly cloudy today from 1 to 4 p.m. here in New York City.
Well, I think NASA's going to stream it. Don't look at it, whatever you do.
I have the right glasses. I've got the glasses.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
I'm going to stream it because Bonnie Tyler's going to be singing Total Eclipse of the Heart.
You know, Conrad and I were laughing about that this morning. She said, isn't her voice gone? I was like, I don't know.
I don't know. Could be there.
Anytime anybody wants to sing me some Jim Steinman, I'm in. I'm in. Absolutely.
So
Meatloaf wants to do it. Air Supply wants to do it.
Yeah. Sold. Why not?
Yeah.
They should do a whole like just line up as many bands as you can, but you have to sing this song, and it's just going to be interpretation after interpretation of that one song for 2 hours.
I would rather watch that than the eclipse. I think
be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So it is on Taking Pictures. It is episode 278.
Yep.
For those of you torturing yourself
keeping
by
track
listening
at home
to every episode. it is Tuesday. It's Bill's up in Brooklyn. Yep. Bill Wadman in Brooklyn, New York. Jeffrey Sidoris in Silver Spring, Maryland, just north of our nation's capital.
Just north.
Yeah.
I think we get a 74% eclipse. You get a 82% eclipse, or you know what I mean? Whatever the...
Right. Yeah, we're not on the, what do they call it? The totality?
Yeah, the line of totality.
Right. I love that. That's a great band name, Line of Totality.
I love the good band names.
Yeah. Yeah. So, how are things?
Good. I feel weird recording on... Hey, how did we end up recording on Tuesday in the first place?
Because way, way back in the day... you said, hey, you want to do a test and see where it goes on Tuesday?
That was on Tuesday?
Yeah.
Really?
And you put it up that day and we were like, okay, you want to do it next Tuesday? Yeah, sure. Let's do it next Tuesday. And that was it. It was really just very arbitrary.
This right there is a prime example of how you can't plan everything.
Right.
You just got to sometimes you just jump gotta, in. 6 years later, I haven't left this microphone.
Right.
Yeah, it's a good thing. All right, so we got a lot of stuff on the...
Got a lot of stuff. Can I tell you that I'm still... there are still things about Windows that I don't understand.
Wait, still?
Right.
Was there ever anything about Windows you understood? What are you referring
bit, yeah.
to specifically?
Well, okay, so I did not release the book. It should go up today. Should go up today. Found a couple things that I wanted to update and found a couple things that were errors that I missed. And so I'm testing it on all platforms. I'm testing it on, you know, as many devices and platforms as I have. And I got to tell you, the by far the worst experience is trying to look at a PDF in Windows 10.
Is there built-in PDF? There is built-in PDF support in Windows now. There isn't? You still can't double-click on a PDF?
It still has, like, you go to the App Store. What do you want to look for? You know, it's like, come on.
Really?
Really? Really?
I got to tell you, I mean, I was a Windows user for, you know, decades. And, you know, I guess it's fine. But one of the reasons why I always liked the idea of Mac OS was the fact that you could print straight to a PDF inside the print dialog. I thought that was the coolest thing.
Yeah.
Look, I could just make a PDF right inside the print dialog. That's amazing.
It's like a little basic thing that so you download Adobe Reader and then it's like, well, do you want Adobe Reader to be your default PDF? Yeah. It's like, come on, just open the damn thing.
And what else comes along with Adobe Reader?
If you don't check the correct or if you don't deselect the checkbox, then you get McAfee antivirus, which is a whole other
I remember that. Can of worms. That was like,
they still do that. Yeah.
Oh, God.
what, 15 years in, still bundling McAfee, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah, yeah,
I don't know. It was just, it was a more pleasant experience on my, you know, whatever year old Nexus that worked flawlessly than, you know, the latest, greatest flagship operating system. It's just weird. I don't know. Anyway.
Well, you know, it's later in the show, if we get to some of these user question, email, Twitter stuff, there's one that kind of rounds back around to this. So
okay,
we'll get back to it.
Yeah.
Where do you want to start? Do you want to, jump into this thing we wrote down last week, or do you want to ease into it?
And I think here in the notes, I think it relates to,
it relates to Jim Carrey.
It relates to this Jim Carrey thing that a few people have talked about and sent in. So would you like to start, Mr. Wadman?
Okay. So last week, God, what were we talking about that this ended up coming up? I guess we were talking about purpose again or something. And I think I threw out the idea of, you know, trying to figure out when you know when you're making good work, I think is what I said. You know, how do you know when you're making good work? Like, are you supposed to recognize it, or are others supposed to recognize it? Doesn't your recognition of your own work, whether good or bad or indifferent, depend upon your mood, where you are in your, you know, your cycle of creativity or whatever?
Right. Well, I think you hit on something there. Mood.
Yeah.
How many of us have been making whatever X piece of work, and in the moment, we either think it's really great, or in the moment, we think it's crap. But then if we come back to it minutes, hours, days, months later, you feel different about it. You look at it, you go, oh, you know what? Wait a minute.
Yeah, that's not bad. That's pretty good. Or you come back and you go, wow, that's way too green.
Yeah, what was I thinking?
Yeah.
Oof.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
So there's a subjective quality to good that is partially and maybe even largely dependent on where we're at.
I also think that there's a large percentage of this that involves, you know, stepping away, getting distance, and coming back and looking at it. You get sort of a blindness, like a quality blindness.
Right.
If you're sitting in front of something and you're looking at it, you know, the whole, oh, I'm too close to this to know whether it's good or not. But I do think that when there are times when you're working on something that is really clicking,
mm-hmm.
I feel like I generally know it. When there's something that's coming out and I'm like, yeah, that's coming out exactly the way I want it to. Or, wow, this idea I had is actually working, you know.
I think that's true by and large. Yeah.
Yeah. But do you think that that's an illusion, or do you think that that is that you can trust? I guess the other question is, can you even trust those feelings? You know,
I think you have to trust those feelings because on some level, everything else is a lie. Everything else is an illusion.
Yeah. What does anybody else know that you don't know? You know,
right. And the reason that we cycled this Jim Carrey piece in, Jim Carrey has taken up painting. And what he's doing may not appeal to everyone, but it's true for him. The exploration and the expression is true for him.
Yeah.
A lot of people are chiming in. Critics have chimed in. Oh, it's just crap. It's another example of, you know, an actor thinking he can do X, Y, Z. But frankly, I applaud Jim for trying something new and trying to express himself in a different way. There have been any number of crossover professions that musicians have taken up, art or painting, sure, or vice versa. Tony Bennett famously paints and is a terrific painter.
Yep.
Brian Adams, a whole other career in photography. Nikki Sixx, a whole other career in photography. You know, so the idea that you should pigeonhole or be pigeonholed into one expression is kind of ludicrous. Now, is his art for everyone? Maybe not, but the guy just decided that he's going to start painting. So he's a work in progress, just like his pieces.
Well, I think that there's also a lot of these situations where incumbents, I'm just flipping through this because I watched part of it earlier, but I was just flipping through. The way he stands is really interesting. Like the, like his physicality.
Yeah.
But there's also this idea of the incumbents looking at anybody new and saying, oh, he's just some guy who wants to start painting. Well, you know what? That might be true. And then 10 years from now, he might be the guy, oh, he's been painting for 10 years. It's like, well, yeah, because it takes time to do anything. Yeah, right. This stuff is not instantaneous, you know.
And he's putting in the time, and it seems to be coming from a space of honesty.
Yeah, and he has the freedom to do that, right? Like he has the ability to you know, like I'm just going to buy this place. I'm going to take some time off from making movies because I've got a lot of money, and I'm going to try to make stuff because I do fight with depression and all the rest of it. You know, that we've talked. Jim Carrey is like famously open about his depressive cycles and stuff. So
yeah, absolutely.
So I, you know, hey, good for him. I have absolutely zero problem with that. And, but you know, and especially for somebody with sort of, you know, from a mental health point of view, do whatever it is that seems to make you happy. You know, if painting makes you happy, if painting gives him a satisfaction that acting no longer does, or gives him an objectivity or perceived objectivity that acting no longer does, you know, or even the other way around, Jeffrey, where it's like, he knows, hey, I'm a good comedic actor. People are going to laugh at my jokes, blah, 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 blah. I want something that I'm not necessarily good at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe that's the challenge in there as well. Sure.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, there's like different ways to go about this stuff. But yeah, I think it's, hey, more power to him. But
the idea of good, coming back to that,
is
so malleable. I mean, we've talked about you looking back at some of your early work and some of it holds up and some of it doesn't. And I've looked back at some of my early work and some of it holds up and some of it doesn't. But I think if we're being honest in the creation of it.
Okay.
As a snapshot of where we're at, either with regard to our current technical limitations or our current aesthetic, not limitations, but our current aesthetic, God, what's the word I'm looking for, Bill?
I'm not sure where you're going.
Well, it's a snapshot of where we are. What we make is a snapshot of where we are.
Yeah. 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 Okay. Got it.
You know, I may have seen, I don't know, a new de Kooning piece. And I go, God, I really want to try this type of abstract expressionist. I want to try this kind of action painting and see where it goes. Now, am I going to be good at it? No, not at all.
Right.
You know, in the same way that if I start playing a new sport, I'm not going to be any good at it.
Yeah.
Probably. You know, it takes practice. You've got to put the time in. But the idea of good, I think, becomes a hang up. We get stuck on, is it good? What do we mean by that? Is it good to me?
Is it good
to an audience?
Yeah.
Is it good to...
Does this have meaning in the larger artistic world? Does this make me feel satisfied?
Yes.
Is this going to impress other people? You know, does this have value monetarily? You know what I mean? Like there's all of these kinds of elements of this stuff.
Well, and you know, you as, let's say, a commercial photographer and I guess a fine art photographer, you approach, for example, your dream series, you're approaching that differently than you would a 10-minute corporate gig that you've got to get in and out.
Yep.
The goal is still the same, to make a good photograph,
right?
But the quantification of good.
Yeah, what I mean from
different.
Exactly. What I mean by good in those situations is completely different.
Right. So,
although funny enough, completely different, although in some ways exactly the same, right?
Explain.
There's this sort of overarching definition of quality, whatever that means, right? Where it's just like, no, I want it to be good. I'm using the same word to describe what it is that I want it to be, even though that word means completely different things in different contexts.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
but it rears its head in different ways.
Yeah.
You know, and it could be the subject relationship. It could be the thematic representation that you're going for. I know a photographer who shoots with a lot of different models, subjects.
Yeah.
And there's one particular subject that this photographer shoots with, and that work is consistently more interesting than much of the other work that's produced, in my opinion. So what is it? Because it's not
maybe
an ability.
That model's really good.
Right. I mean, the relationship there, the chemistry there, the trust, whatever that is, it goes above and beyond the equipment and even the ability to use that equipment, because that's kind of a constant, right? Your ability to shoot conceptual work versus a straight portrait, your ability with the hardware doesn't change.
Right. And well, even shooting straight portraits of different people, some people you have chemistry with, some people you don't. Some people, you know, look good through a viewfinder. Some people, you know, immediately. Some people, it takes a little more work to get them looking interesting. Mm-hmm. There's all of those gray areas that even if there's so many podcasts and shows and videos and conversations and articles about, oh, well, you know, you need to master these tools and here's your way to use a light to do this and whatever it is. Like, all of that is great. But even if you have that stuff 100% mastered, you're still nowhere.
Right.
You're still just, you know, you've just knocked down 15 out of 100 questions mm-hmm. that go into something. You still have the other 85. And those are never going to be solved. So
right.
It's like, that's just pretty much a starting point.
So I think the obsession with good, and I'm guilty of it just as much as anybody else is, the obsession with good is just that. It's an obsession. I mean, look, there are... Pick an artist, whether it's a musician or a filmmaker or a, you know, Scorsese has made some crap movies.
Sure.
You know,
The question is whether your perception of your work being good or not affects how you feel about the reasons why you're doing it. And if it's satisfying to you from some sort of emotional level or, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Which is ultimately probably the reason why we're all doing this.
Yeah.
I mean, I know a handful of event photographers who don't give a crap about photography and just, you know, like getting a little paycheck because they're like, hey, it's easy money on the weekends or whatever. But other than that, every photographer I know.
I've tried shooting events, man, and it was not easy in the least.
Oh, I'm not saying it's easy at all. I'm terrible at it. I'm saying that these people see it as guys and girls who are shooting events
and weddings. And
But I guess what I mean is that I know people who shoot events. And certainly not all the people I know who shoot events, but I know some people who shoot events who do it for the money, not for the love of photography.
Sure.
But what I'm saying is that all the rest of the people that I know are doing this because they get some sort of emotional satisfaction out of it. Mm-hmm. And that emotional satisfaction, if all you ever do is make work that you look at and think, God, this is crap.
Right.
That's not going to be very satisfying to you.
No.
At a certain level, you got to feel like you're making progress.
Yeah. It's not going to push you further.
Right.
If you don't like anything that you produce,
right?
Now you can get in a rut, and we've all been there where for a time, you know, I can't do anything right. But eventually, you've got to break through that,
right?
Or you're right, you're just not going to keep doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Then you just stop, and you know, you're all those people who stop.
Wow, eloquent.
I was gonna go somewhere there, but I let it
you're die. Just all those people who stop,
you know, the people who stop, maybe.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. It's I find as I get older and been doing this longer, I think I better recognize which work is good and which isn't, and or rather I have more confidence in my ability to recognize that and care a little bit less what other people think. You know, if I shoot something and I think, yeah, I like that a lot, like that's good. And somebody says, that's all right. And I'm like, yeah, I don't care. I still think it's good. You know,
but do you care or do you really
not
care
more? I used to care more. I care a lot less. I mean, look, no one is completely immune to the opinions of the people around them.
Right.
Or at least I don't believe that they are. You know, some people could say, you know, the other, I guess it was 2 days ago. God, how did I get on this? Somehow something about Picasso got in my head. And I realized that I never really looked at, people always talk about Picasso being this young phenom artist, right? Like, you know, all the stuff that he started, all the mask stuff and, you know, the five mademoiselles and all that. That was when he was 24 years old, you know? So you're right, like, okay, so what was he doing when he was 15 or whatever? And there are paintings that survive of Picasso when he was 15. And they look like John Singer Sargent paintings. They're like these really beautiful, well done, sort of quasi perfect, you know what I mean? Representations of reality. It's definitely one of those situations where people say, oh, they draw like that because they can't draw. And it's like, no, he can draw.
Right.
He chose to make strange representations of these things as an artistic choice. But you know, I'm looking at the work, and you know, people were telling him, this is amazing. You know, like, look how great you are. You're showing in this show at 16 years old and whatever it is. And, you know, but for him, he was like, I guess that isn't satisfying to me. Or at the time, painting was going in different directions and he wanted to be in the forefront of it. And he had moved to Paris and, you know, all the rest of it. So I think that there's, you can listen to the people on the outside, but I don't know that listening to people on the outside ever makes people go in directions, go positively in a new direction. If you feel like somebody's telling you, you know, Jeffrey, you know, your stuff really needs to be, you really should do stuff like this, you're always going to resent it a little, even if you do take their advice, because they came up with it and you didn't. You know what I mean? Like, it just feels weird to go in a direction because somebody else says walk that way. I feel like the real changes only ever happen when somebody kind of figures that out on their own, or mm-hmm. at least decides on their own that they want to go in a certain direction. And that involves trying to figure out what you think is the right thing for you and what's good for you, and making work that you think feels natural or progressive.
Right.
I guess progress, man, that's an interesting idea. Just like, you know, you and I, or anyone out there, can make lovely, perfect work for 40 years that all kind of looks the same. Is that good? Or is that kind of not lazy, but just sort of stagnant?
Yeah. What's more valuable, consistency or evolution?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But progress. I think even within that consistency, there's progression, whether it may be subtle refinements.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, look at somebody like Chuck Close, who has kind of consistently refined his, at least one of his methods of portraiture.
Right. But his super giant photorealistic stuff from the 70s into the more abstract sort of circles and the, you know, the sort right. of the pixelated right. stuff.
There was the progression. That was the change.
That's a big change. I don't know that he's changed much since then. You know, mm-hmm. in a large way. I mean, you go see his new work, and I saw a show of like textiles and stuff that he had done a couple of years ago, and it was fine, but it was definitely just sort of a twist on what he's been doing for 20 years. You know, it wasn't mm-hmm. something mm-hmm. new. So, you know, but you know, he's an older guy, but at least he's like moving forward in some way. You know,
right? Well, and that idea of transformation. I mean, if you talk to curators or conservators, or you know. The academic side of art, that this idea of transformation is one of the sort of core tenets that has to be present, right, for right. it to be art.
Yeah.
Whether it's a transformation of materials or a transformation of ideas, or you know, something transformative in the ideology of the work.
Well, I also think that there's a lot of people out there. I was just to go to different arts for a second. I was reading yeah. stuff about John Coltrane and Miles Davis this morning, and they were talking about the quintet in the late 50s and sort of mid 50s. And, you know, it was like, oh, Coltrane played with Miles from 1956 to 1958 or whatever the hell it was, you know?
Mm-hmm,
and mm-hmm. you look at it and you go, oh, they made 6-7 albums in those years that are considered some of the greatest, you know, jazz albums of all time. That was 2 years,
right?
You know, or a year. Some of these right. people,
there was
know,
just this explosive yeah, period of
Picasso's
collaboration.
Blue period was 18 months or something. You're like, 18 right. months? Like, this isn't, people are still talking about it now. You know, it's 18 months in a 90 year life. You know, it's nothing.
Do you think that, okay, looking at the Miles Coltrane connection.
Yeah.
Did they know the work was good? Or did it even matter because it was different
so
than what they
heroin?
Had done before? No. It was different than what had come before it. Were they even concerned with it?
Well, at that time, the prestige stuff that I'm talking about, I think was an excellent form of what was going on then. It wasn't really a shift yet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I think that they knew they were a hell of a band, you know?
Yeah.
But then you realize, you know, why they broke up, which, by the way, they say is heroin. Kids, don't do heroin.
Don't do heroin.
And you think, okay, these guys are making this mind-blowing work that is still considered the greatest thing of whatever art form they're doing, and it broke up because, you know, they were doing drugs, or so-and-so wouldn't show up to gigs, or, you know, so whatever the small reason is that in hindsight is just like, wait, you broke up the band because of something that could be a solvable problem? You know what I mean? Like,
it didn't seem to be a creative difference or a compatibility difference.
And even
difference
if it was, don't you realize how much good stuff is going on here that, you know, right. you how about you fix the little thing that's the problem? But at the time, you probably don't even know it because at the time, it's just what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And I think mm-hmm. that's the other thing. I mean, I remember hearing was it Behind the Music? Is that the VH1 thing?
That was the VH1 thing, yeah.
Or Classic Albums or one of those things. Right, anyway, right. They were talking to the guys in Bon Jovi about Slippery When Wet.
Yep.
And they said, you know.
Terrific record, by the way.
When you guys were making this record, did you realize how big it would be? And Richie Sambora was like, yeah, when we were doing the final mixes, we really thought we had something. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But that's mm-hmm. rare. Most of the time it's just, yeah, we made an album, we put it out, or, you know, how many actors do you hear where they say every movie I've made, from the one that was, you know, won Academy Awards to the one that got 3% on Rotten Tomatoes, in the day-to-day thing of doing it, you're just making the movie. Like,
right.
you're just doing
the work.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You're just doing the best you can on whatever it is, whether it ends up being this phenomenal thing or not. Is not necessarily this obvious.
Well,
in the moment.
I think that's one of the reasons, anyway, where people go, you know, so many people working on a movie. How did they not know it was crap? So many people have to see it. Well, because everybody's just doing, they've got their head down and they're doing their thing.
Yeah. He's doing the color correcting. This guy has the footage and is trying to edit as well as possible. The lady who was shooting the thing, you know, was working with the light she had that day because they ended up having to shoot.
Absolutely.
You know, whatever,
you know,
the
costumers are doing the best they can.
Yeah.
The makeup effects people are doing their thing. And,
you know,
everybody's just trying to do the best they can. I really do believe that.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's this weird sense of altruism, but I really do think that within the confines of creativity, everybody is trying to do the best they can.
Yeah.
They're trying to do great work.
And all of those people, like a little version of, is it Inside Out? Is that the one where it's all the little people in the girl's head?
Oh, right. Yes. I think that's what the Pixar one.
Yeah. You know, in the same way, all of those little people are in each of our heads while we're working and fighting with each other, all trying to do, you know, your technical thing is trying to do the best it can. Composition, you're trying to do the best you can. You're trying to deal with the subject as best you can. And then still at the end, sometimes you stuff it and you get a picture that is just like, yeah, wow, I really missed on that one. It happens, you know? Despite best tendencies, it's not that you didn't work hard enough. It's not that you didn't, you know, maybe if you look at it on aggregate, on average, over time, you're improving. But that doesn't mean that every picture you take today is better than the one yesterday.
Right.
And that's okay, because it's like it's this slow, you know, 1.25 steps forward, you know, 1 1/8 step back.
Right.
You know.
Well, there's this famous story about Elvis, before he did the 68 comeback special, he was, the story goes, he was walking down either Hollywood or Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles, and nobody recognized him. And this was just it was a couple years after he had been, you know, the biggest thing on the planet.
Sure.
But he'd gone away and, you know, went into the army and came back and he's like, I got to get back on top. And he did this 68 comeback special, and then did this show at the International Hotel, which is now the Hilton, July 31st, 1969. And that show was the show that, according to him and people around him, he chased for the rest of his life. That was the pinnacle. And that became the benchmark of every show that followed it, was to try and equal how he felt, how the audience reacted, whatever it was about that night, that was his sort of holy grail.
Yeah. And even in what we do, every shoot's a performance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. By the way, Jeffrey, we can't go on together with Suspicious Minds.
We just can't. No. Oh my God.
That is a really good song though.
It's a great song. There's a documentary of them doing rehearsals for the tour at the home that he rented in like Brentwood or something, and all the guys are playing in the living room, and he's just he's just doing it, right? He's just going for it. It's just, you see that energy, that charisma.
Yeah. He, did we talk about that, the crazy movie, the Nixon, Elvis Nixon movie?
Oh, with Michael Shannon.
Yeah.
I don't know if we talked about it, but I watched it.
It was
Kevin Spacey
cute.
As Nixon.
Yeah. You know what else I watched the other day is I finally got around to watching Chef, which we had watched that scene. Remember where he comes and yells at the reviewer?
Yeah. Terrific movie.
It's a cute movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like Jon Favreau.
I do as well. It does feel a little, you know, if the weight of the movie, the weight of time that they spend on him before he gets the food truck to spending on the food truck, I think it's a little front heavy. But overall, super cute.
Oh, I thought it was a nice setup.
Oh,
and I love the relationship
amazing.
That comes around with Oliver Platt, who I think is a really underrated actor.
Oh, he's fantastic. Also excellent in The West Wing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Oliver Platt. Oliver Platt. You got anything more or you want to move on?
Oh, we could go on for a long time, but we should probably move on.
All right. I've watched about a third of this Oliphant background video. I kind of want to watch the rest of it. And can we put that on the list for next week, but we'll put a link in the show notes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. What we're talking about, guys and girls, is an interview with Peter Hurley.
Yeah.
And Sarah Oliphant, namesake of Oliphant backdrops in New York City, who her backdrops are, would you say, top of the game?
Yeah. I mean, yes. I think that she is one of the very small handful of people who do this at this level. I mean, all of the backdrops you see in Vanity Fair that Seliger and Annie use, they're all Oliphant backdrops. I would say though that it's really funny because there are moments where Peter Hurley seems really bored.
He's like,
well, there's moments where like she's saying stuff and he's like, yeah. And he's like walking around, following her around, but he just seems, I don't know. It's just really funny. There's like one little chunk that I was watching this morning. I was like, wow, dude, like get into it a little bit.
Right.
I do think though, how much of a headache I would get being around that many fumes all day long, even in a big room like that.
Ooh. No, she's got a beautiful space.
Oh, it's gorgeous, but still, ooh, you know, yeah.
Where is Bushwick, by the way?
Is that where she is?
Yeah. Bushwick.
Oh, that's, that's out, it's out in Brooklyn. It's, northeast of me.
Yeah.
A place you could get apparently a big space, to paint in. Because you can't imagine. I mean, yes, she rents these things out, and yes, they cost hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars, but still takes a lot of time, and that's a big space, and you know what I mean. Like that's
right.
This is not an easy or cheap thing to do. So,
what do they rent for?
You know, the times that I've looked, I think it's like $500 a day for.
Oh wait,
for,
here we go. Film, television, video, and wow, it's according to usage. So it's almost like her. Wow.
Backdrops are characters or actors.
Yeah, they have a day rate for usage. Film, TV, video, and internet is $565. Print is $440 for 3 days.
Interesting.
Wow, so internet usage is more expensive than a print catalog.
Oh, interesting.
Editorial, $335 for 3 days.
Yeah, see, it's not that bad.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to, you know, use one, and they cost, you know, whatever, say $1,500 or $2,000. Like if you really want one, it's great to just, you know, go get one.
Drop the coin. She's got some beautiful ones.
Oh,
their technique
absolutely beautiful.
Is kind of amazing.
It is definitely though, if you flip through, because I think on the site, as I recall, you can look at, oh, this is number 538 and whatever,
right.
You know what I mean? Like different ones.
Right.
I think some of them hit more than others. You know what I mean? Like, and I wonder, like, just as we've been saying, I'm sure she thinks this one nailed it, you know?
Right.
And I wonder if you commissioned her to make one for you, how much of a right of refusal you have. You know what I'm saying?
Like when you actually go into the studio and they unroll it and you go,
Yeah,
not really what I was after.
Exactly. Yeah. I wonder.
Yeah.
I mean, it's gotta happen.
I wonder, maybe there's a process like an iterative approval process where like, here's where we've got so far. Here's our base color. What do you think of this? Or, right. Or, you know, is it a case where, you know, she's Sarah Oliphant and you got to know what you're getting going in and,
right.
you know.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know. Yeah, yeah. I also think this is.
She seems lovely, though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I know people who know her, so it's kind of it's interesting. It's also interesting watching her just walk barefoot on these things, you know, as I guess you would. But yeah. Anyway, so we'll put a link in the show notes. Petapixel has it in a big article about it with some examples of the backdrops on magazines and things. But if you're interested in this kind of thing, let's come back to it next week, because I want to dig a little deeper and I want to make sure I've watched it all. But it's good. Hey, before we get to anything else here, you mentioned that you don't like looking at 4K TV. Why is that?
I don't. My stepmother has this gorgeous, I mean, it's no fault of the television. I don't even know how big it is, like 70 something inches, 80 something. It's giant.
Yeah.
And it's a big OLED TV that they just got, 4K. But watching, like we were watching an episode of Shield, okay? Mm-hmm. And it was so crisp. It reminded me of watching like video from the 60s, like when videotape first kind of came in, you know, like watching like Dark Shadows or something, right. Where it had that sort of unnatural crispness to it.
I'm going to ask you a dumb question just so I...
Yeah.
Did you go in and make sure it wasn't, you know, tuned to have like lots of sharpening on and all that like weird DSP
like that? Okay. I did not.
A lot of times when you get them out of the box, they're way over bright, way over sharpened, you know what I mean? Too saturated and all that kind of stuff. So
yeah, it was uncomfortable.
Could be a tuning thing.
You know, I found myself not being able to watch too much of it. And this was the other thing. It was very obvious what was CG and what was shot, what was practical. There was a much more of a
well, that makes sense.
Difference between, yeah, you know, seeing them. Whereas, you know, if I watch, I don't know, what's the new Marvel thing with like everybody in it? Defenders?
Defenders.
Yeah.
I watched the first episode, by the way. I wasn't taken. But
it was okay. But yeah. I mean, you got to like catch up with all the characters and everything, whatever. Yeah. Watching that on like an iPad or even on just a regular 42-inch TV, it felt smoother, for lack of a better word.
Interesting. My guess is that would be more to do with the tuning rather than 4K in particular. That would be my
guess.
Well,
okay, but if that's the case, if that's the case, why not, you know, why not set the factory defaults to something where you're not going to go, ooh, wow, that's a little garish.
Well, because I think that the average person thinks, oh, look how sharp it looks.
Oh my gosh. It's awful.
People like things looking, you know, it's like the TV manufacturers realized years ago, if you have the brightest, most saturated one on the line at the Best Buy, you know what I mean?
The OLED, like color reproduction and black levels, gorgeous.
Oh, yeah,
gorgeous.
Well, it's like plasma, right? Well, OLED, when there's nothing in black, it's black, right?
You know, there's like, they don't have to make black, right?
Yeah,
right,
yeah,
right.
Exactly. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, so we have a handful of friends over to watch the Game of Thrones each week, and we have a 720p Acer projector from, I don't know, 5 years ago we bought, which, right, by the way, first bulb still working. It's amazing.
Wow.
Although
the little one that's in your closet behind the bed?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, but wow.
We pull it out and put it on a stand and put out a 9-foot roll of seamless and we project into that. So we have like movie nights and stuff. And so we had people over here last night and I'm like watching, and there was like a scene where they're, you know, north of the wall and Jon Snow's coat is like fur and whatever it is. And I'm looking at it and I'm like, you know, this thing's 100-something inches across. I mean, it's 9 feet, you know, I mean, it's huge. And I'm 8-10 feet away, and this is a 720p projector, and that looks great,
right?
I mean, you know, if this one died suddenly and I had to buy a new one, would I buy a 1080p? Sure, but this looks fine, you know. And I'm fairly particular about this stuff. It doesn't look great if you have text on the screen and it's small, because 720p is not a lot, but like moving video, 720p looks great, you know. So yeah, I maybe you're right. Maybe if I had a 4K projector, I'd complain that it was too sharp.
Yeah, I don't know. It just, I now I want to I want to go look at another one and kind of, you know, muck around with it a little bit and see where you can get it to. Because if that's the case, if that's what 4K TV is going to look like, that that sort of
you don't
disconnect,
want it.
I don't want it. Yeah, I don't want it.
You know, for what it's worth, also from a photographic point of view, when you're shooting at higher resolutions, you know, like my new camera versus my old camera versus my original 5D, you know, 12 to 21 to 51 megapixels, when you're retouching and doing work and compositing and stuff, it's both easier and harder. It's easier because you have more pixels to work with and you can get cleaner masks and that kind of stuff. But it's also harder because there's more information there, so you have to be more precise about how you're changing it, you know. So it's this affects everything. In the same way that they said that they had to, I took pictures of a makeup artist the other day that I worked with last year, and he was saying, I said, have they changed makeup a lot in the last few years? Like, has technology improved makeup? And he said, oh, absolutely. He says, you know, we can't use the same foundations we used to use because you can
like
see
that. Because
them.
Of 4K? Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. You know, even it's sort of the whole thing where they had to swap out sections of the Friends apartment set or something. You know what I mean? Because the stuff was not built very well. And then they went to
Friends
HD.
Was in HD?
I think the later ones were. Huh. Or some example like that. And you know, they had to change the makeup and change parts of the set because they built it for SD. And it, you know, like you wouldn't notice that brick wall is not a brick wall. Well, now it's not you can't be a printed flat anymore. It needs to be, you know, fake brick or, you know, whatever the thing is. That kind of stuff happens. So it complicates things a lot.
Isn't that weird? It's got to be better fake.
Yeah. It's like, why don't you just build the GD wall?
Right. Right.
Gary Newman. Wow. Haven't thought about him in a while.
He's got a new record.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
I admittedly was a little late to the game with Gary Newman. This popped up Huck magazine. I really like Huck magazine and they have some very cool editorials. That's right. Cars. That's where I, like so many people who are probably listening, when you say Gary Newman, that's the song that pops into their head. And what's interesting is, you know, he's kind of known as this electro, you know, synth pop god.
Yeah.
But that was never his goal. His goal was always to blend electronic music with traditional music, with traditional instruments.
Right.
But what I found interesting was here's a guy who, and no disrespect meant at all, is in some ways a shadow of what he was in terms of popularity.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. He might be doing,
he's an icon from the past.
Yes. Okay. He might be doing more interesting work now, which I think that he is. Absolutely. If you listen, especially to the new record and some of the collaborations he's done with Nine Inch Nails. But it's gotta be a strange thing where you're putting in either just as much time or maybe even more time and still not hitting that former success, that former sort of, you're not hitting those numbers that you once did or the notoriety that you once had.
How much of that has to do with being there at the, okay. Can I give like a 30 second twist on this?
Yeah, sure. I want to come back to something, but
yeah. Okay. Finish your thing then. I'll get to it in a minute.
The whole point of bringing this up was here's a guy who was, you know, at the top of pop music for a while, is still doing the work, but goes through everything that you and I and 90% of the people listening, he's an introvert. He questions everything he does. He deals with depression. He deals
apparently
with thinking the work
Asperger's
is crap.
Asperger's too. So he's like got a interpersonal thing too, you know, that he has to fight. Yeah.
But has documented much of his creative journey. And this Huck article talks about the making of the new record. During the making of his new album, Savage, he shared updates online every step of the way, from creative blocks and bad moods to the excitement of pulling it all together. Now, a lot of this is, you know, pay X number of dollars and you can get this. But
sure.
The fact that he's documenting it in a arguably public forum is kind of interesting, and he seems very honest and unassuming from this interview. A musician once told me that Cars had become an anthem for people with Asperger's. Did you ever think of that song along those lines, or has it always meant something different to you? And Gary answers, Cars is just about me being set upon in London by a couple of men in a car who took a dislike to me. Maybe I cut them off. I don't know what happened. I ended up driving onto the pavement just to get away. It's something that stuck in my mind for a very long time. When it came time to put some lyrics to this little riff I'd come up with, it was nothing more than a recording of an unfortunate experience, which made me realize that a car is like a small personal tank in the modern world. It cocoons you from violence and horrible things, and it can safely take you away.
See, there's a thing further down. It said, we had 3 days in the studio and could only afford to have a synthesizer for two of them. There was no time for second takes. If there were bum notes, you just had to leave them in. But that was really exciting, partly because of those constraints and partly because you knew something special was happening. I loved every minute of that. The promise of what was just around the corner, the realization of all these things you dreamed about.
It's kind of neat, right?
He speaks well. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, go ahead. You started to say something.
So there's a band called Buffalo Tom. Did you ever listen to Buffalo Tom?
Early 90s. No.
Okay. So they're an early 90s indie sort of rock band, power pop kind of thing.
Okay.
And they had a couple albums that were very well regarded, and I was a fan of theirs, and my wife was a fan of theirs. And then we got to know a lot of the guys, the lead singer and his brothers, because they're all these Boston guys who are now up there. And Bill, the lead singer of the band and I think main songwriter, is now like does real estate. I mean, he still plays and does stuff, but like he's a real estate agent and like hardcore, you know, family guy and whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I always thought about it. I always sort of wonder in my head, it's like, does, you know, they hit in 92, 93, like around that time, right? That was sort of just a little too late for the kind of music that they were doing. If they were made that music in 1988 or 87, they would have been a big deal. And then Bill has younger brothers who are all also amazing musicians, but the time at which their music coming out of Boston would have been the kind of thing that got picked up and went national. You know, it's in the same way that Minneapolis had its day and Seattle had its day in the early 90s, right? Like it moved right from Boston to Seattle in the late 80s to early 90s. And there weren't a lot of bands coming out of Boston at that time and whatever. And it's, you know, how much of this stuff is in some ways, you know, not that he's not making, and I haven't listened to this record, the new Newman record. So it could be incredible, but it might be that the world's just not ready for that kind of music right now, you know, and how much, mm-hmm. how much of an, of a thing that is, how much of an element that is in the success of whatever it is you're trying to do. I just find that whole idea interesting.
Yeah.
And whether the people who were on the cusp of it and had multiple albums on major labels, but are now out of the music business because you can't make it work, how much resentment there is or is not in that,
mm-hmm.
you know, that feeling of, wow, I was right there and the world just sort of went against me at the last minute kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
well, I think, you know, if he's still doing it 30 years on, 40 years on, whatever it is.
Yeah.
There's gotta be an internal.
Oh yeah. I think
joy.
He loves. Absolutely. And I think the, you know, this guy for, as just one example, totally was doing it for the love of it, but mm-hmm. it could have been also his livelihood, you know, and probably it was right. for a while and isn't now. And I think it just, that's sort of like this interesting twist on the way the world works. I'll have to go read the rest of this article. This is interesting. The Newman article.
Yeah, it's interesting. He's well-spoken. I've seen him in a couple of interviews and, I like him. He seems like a good guy.
Yeah. 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 It's interesting. I would play guitar in the demos and then get another guitarist to play it properly on the record. Same with keyboards and vocals. I'd bring in fantastic female backup singers and have my own voice right down in the mix. In my mind, I was making it more musical, better quality. But what I was actually doing was taking out all the ingredients that were important to people who liked me before.
Yeah.
So this newfound love of music and new understanding of what I've done wrong, I made an album by myself called Sacrifice, which is so heavy and industrial sounding. I really enjoyed that because it was music that I actually wanted to make. I had no record deal. It didn't seem like I was going to get one. I was massively in debt, $600,000 at that point. life pretty much sucked, really. I'd effed it completely, royally effed on many levels. Yet my support from Gemma, being able to make this one album, was enough for me to find my way back again at the 11th hour. There, you know, there's also this thing of where people you really liked, or musicians or photographers or whatever, oh my God, hey, whatever happened to that guy? And they just sort of disappear for a while, and they come back and you realize that they spent 6 years drinking, or, you know what I mean?
Right.
5 years traveling the world trying to find themselves, or
right.
in the sink of depression, or whatever the thing is, you know?
Or, you know, 6 years in their home studio trying to find what it was that they felt they'd lost.
Yeah. Or coming up with that new thing that breaks it wide open.
Yeah, absolutely. That's another one. Sure.
Yeah. It's funny. I was, there's this couple that we see up at the coffee shop in the morning, and they're older. I think Conrad and I see them as sort of the older version of us, you know?
Nice.
And, they're very sweet. And the wife was working on a big Sudoku thing. And I was like, you do Sudoku? She's like, yeah, you know, I think I broke this one wide open. And all I could think was that scene in Pollock. You know, where she's like, Pollock,
you did it,
done it. You broke it wide open.
You broke it wide open. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
By the way, that movie written by Jennifer Jason Leigh's mother.
Really?
Yep. Learned that in an interview with Jennifer Jason Leigh the other day.
Huh.
That's exactly the sound that I made when I found that out.
Right.
Got anything else with the Gary Numan? I think maybe there's more in here, but we can swing back around to it if you want.
No, I mean, go take a look at it, listeners. Let us know what you think. Podcast at ontakingpictures.com. I found it really fascinating. And I like that they included in this Huck article a number of clips, both vintage and current, to kind of give you a snapshot of the evolution of Gary Numan.
Yeah.
If you're not real familiar with his work or how he's kind of transformed both his look and his career over the years.
Yeah. I agree. All right. So we've got a few things in here from listeners. We got a little time. So can we jump into some of these questions?
Wait, Jonathan Kane. Oh, Jonathan Crane. I was like, Jonathan Kane from Journey emailed us.
He's the keyboardist, isn't he?
Get Steve back.
Yeah. There's your answer.
There's your response. Yeah. It's not Journey without Steve. Next.
Jonathan wrote in with a whole bunch of questions.
Right.
Or a whole bunch of a big long email about how he's kind of sick of social media. He's sending prints to friends as a way to share his work, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I might steal the idea. But he had a couple questions.
Yeah.
And I thought these could be fun. I do have two questions that stem from this. First, do you have any recommendations of how to stay connected with other photographers' photography while remaining mostly offline? I try to go to New York City to visit a museum every once in a while, but can't make the trip too often due to costs. At the same time, I willfully cut myself off from things like the OTP Google Plus group. My initial thought is that photo books might be the way to go if I can find some cheap used copies. I guess the problem with going straight to photo books is that A, it's expensive.
Yeah,
B,
it can be. Sure.
Not everything ends up printed in a book. You know, a lot of stuff doesn't get there. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a very specific set of stuff that ends up being made into books.
Yeah. And I think unless you live in New York or, you know, Chicago or LA or whatever, or DC, you know, have access to museums and galleries, going cold turkey on the online stuff cuts you off from a huge majority or a huge pool of work that you can otherwise, you know, can't find.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, man, the internet really is quite the double-edged sword.
Absolutely.
I mean, when I read some of the things that he says in here about, you know, just feeling kind of sick and tired of reading these posts and the noise and the whatever, you know, I sympathize with all of those things. You know, there's many times I'm looking at my Twitter feed and I'm like, why am I even looking at this? What do I care?
Right.
You know?
Right.
I think we talked about it hundreds of episodes ago, but maybe it's worth revisiting at some point, sort of techniques and strategies for using the internet for good without getting bogged down in what's evil, you know?
Mm-hmm.
because that is a whole thing. But do you have any other thoughts about books versus libraries? If you have a good library,
yeah. If you've got a good library, but again, that still doesn't solve the problem of what you mentioned about a lot of things not getting printed. In books. Books are expensive. I mean, photo books are very expensive, and the ones that you want are kind of sought after, so they're not going to be that much cheaper if you can find them on the used market. Typically,
yeah.
Would you say that's fair?
Well, I find that the photo book used market is fascinating in the sense that some books you go look for that cost $50 originally now cost $600, and other ones cost 60 cents with $4.95 mm-hmm. shipping. You know, a lot of classic books, the kind of stuff that if you're really into portraiture and you want to get a book of Avedon stuff and a book of Annie stuff and a book of whatever it is, you can buy a lot of those books pretty cheap. But if you're trying to look for stuff that's off the beaten path, you know, even finding the books, I mean, you have some relationships with some of these book companies. So sometimes they send you stuff to review and that, you know,
yeah, like they do.
So right there. But a lot of those photographers, you get the books, you didn't know a lot of them before you get the books, right? I mean, there's a lot that are sort of like, oh, I hadn't realized that this person was out there and look at this great work they're doing. So How would you even know to look for that book if those people hadn't sent it to you? Or if you weren't online at the Phaidon site to look at whatever their new books are. And, you know, if you want to stick with staying offline, then, you know, then you're kind of a moot point.
Right. It's a little more difficult, Jonathan, if you really do want to stay offline. But, you know, I think books are certainly a good choice. There are a lot of self-published books being produced now, either directly by photographers or by smaller publishers like Hoxton Mini Press or Falling Press, or, you know, there are a number of them, just, you know.
What about sort of meetups or organizations or groups or, you know what
well,
I mean?
Well, yeah, clubs. But you've kind of got to be online to see when they are, right? To find out information about them. So
it's
that,
really
that
taken over everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough. I think it's tricky. All right. Then the second half of the question, and this is where we get back to what your initial thing about Windows, right? Mm-hmm. He said, I've actually been in the market. Second is a tech question. I've been doing only some very simple editing of files before printing using free software with fairly limited capabilities. However, the availability of less expensive professional solutions such as Affinity Photo has me thinking it's maybe time to work on this side of my photography skills, especially now that I'm sending people actual prints and I'm feeling some self-imposed pressure to raise the quality of what I send. I've been in the market for a new PC for a while now, primarily because I'm not awfully literate when it comes to hardware specs. Every time I visit Newegg, quickly become overwhelmed by the combination of options, also not knowing what I really need. So I give up and go back to using the PC at the public library. Recently, you spent a lot of time talking about hardware, but I've had a sense that it was the higher professional side of things. I was wondering if you had a recommendation for minimum specs for somebody like me, who's just a hobbyist or on a small budget, but would like to a screen that faithfully represents a print, some sort of digital editing equivalent of buying a Rebel or a used 5D Mark II. This is not an easy question. And very much depends on what you mean by budget. You know what I mean?
I mean, look, a 5D Mark II, you can get one on the used market for what?
Right.
$300 or $400 or $500?
The computer equivalent of a 5D Mark.
The computer equivalent. You know, a lot of companies now replace their hardware every 2 or 3 years. And a lot of times you can look at auctions and get pretty capable PCs for pennies on the dollar.
Yeah. I think if you wanted to minimum specs, let's say you're, I don't know, a dual core Intel processor from the last 8 years, you know, 4 or 8 gigs of RAM, let's say 8 gigs of RAM.
Yeah, it wouldn't go any less than.
I would strongly recommend that you have some sort of SSD, at least for the boot drive, if not your storage of your pictures. So 256 gig SSD or something just to get started, and then some storage on the side. The tricky thing actually is what you say there, where you say a faithful representation of your pictures. A good monitor and profiling or calibrating that monitor, that right there is a big chunk of the money that people spend on this stuff.
Yes, but in fairness, if you don't want to go 4K, if you want to stay with a 1080p yeah. monitor, there are terrific sub $200 1080p monitors out there.
Yeah, you also need. Yeah, you need. Right, but you also want one that is theoretically IPS and not TN panel. You know, and then you need to buy a 100.
What's the new one? There's a new kind of panel too. It's not TN.
Yeah, there's like that middle ground one, right? And even the TN panels have gotten a lot better over the past few years. It's just sort of a gamut issue. And a lot of it, actually, the funny thing is when it comes to editing pictures and printing them out, sure, there's the color shift kind of stuff. But the biggest problem is just that most monitors out of the box are way too bright. Your monitor, if anybody's, you know, has one of those calibration pucks, you know, you should be at like 120 nits, like not that bright.
Not at 300 or 400 or 500.
Exactly. You know, I mean,
you don't want to burn your retinas when you're sitting there editing. If your eyes are starting to water after editing your photo for a half hour,
yeah,
it's too bright.
Yeah, the brightness of my screen. It's funny when I put the calibration thing on and it goes through and it. I have a set to my target luminance and it goes all the way to the bright and then it goes and I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, that's kind of gray. Is that really where the white level is?
Because it starts out. Yeah.
Because it's like super funny. Bright white and it just dims it down into like what I think is sort of bright gray. But when I take my stuff and I hit print and I go to the printer, it's like, oh no, this is the right brightness for, you know, what the reality of this image is. And that's the biggest thing. That's the biggest hurdle to cross. So,
And maybe when you are editing, also don't work in such a bright room that you feel like you have to turn up your monitor to compete.
Yeah.
You know, work in a little bit more subdued environment, and that will not the grayness that Bill talked about won't seem so gray.
Right.
If your ambient light is down a little.
The funny thing is that it only looks gray because of how bright it could be. And it's funny, you know, when the new iMac, even brighter screen. I'm like, no, I don't want brighter screen.
Right.
You know, there was actually a big problem with some of even the Dell UltraSharp monitors, which are great bang for the buck. If you're looking for a good, like a really good monitor for not a ton of money, keep an eye on the Dell refurb page. Dell refurb monitors. I think that there's actually a Dell outlet monitors. If you can find a ultra sharp, which is their IPS stuff, on some of these, on here, that could be a really good way to go to save a bunch of money on something that's pretty good. Right. But the one of the problems, Jeffrey, was that the lowest power setting on a few of the models was too high to get down to the luminance you needed, right? Like even at its lowest level, it still wasn't down where it needed because it was so incredibly bright. And it ended up using the pixels to pull the brightness of white down. So even on white, the pixels weren't fully open.
Wow.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. You'd think that there would be some sort of almost like an ND filter that you could put on the surface.
Yeah. You would think, wouldn't you? Yeah, they've got ultra sharp 24-inch monitors for $189 on here. So that's pretty good.
24 or is that a 21?
That's 24.
Mm-hmm.
And these are, I'm assuming, 1080p monitors. I don't see the actual. Yeah, so they have 27-inch. Oh, refurbished Infinity Edge ultra sharp monitor for $219. So there are monitors here if you didn't want to go 4K, although if you're going to buy a monitor nowadays and you're doing photo work, I highly recommend a high DPI monitor.
But then you've got to up the video card to deal with it.
Yeah, but most modern video cards are fine with 4K. Here, you got to remember, our computers are super old.
That's true.
I mean, I updated my video card a few years ago to deal with my 4K monitor, and then I updated it again. What are you still running, an AMD what?
6850.
it won't work in 4K?
No.
But here's the thing. You could buy $100, $99 750.
Yeah, I could get a 750 Ti and be fine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's
Even the new 1050, the 10 series, good at 1050 and they work just fine.
Yeah. All right. The other question we got from Twitter was asked of both us and Ted Forbes. So let's see who answers first.
Yep. I responded to that.
Oh, did I? Oh, I said, oh, there you go. His question was, any thoughts on misprints in a run of books adding to the value of that run? It's a thing with music, photos too. So basically there's examples of, say, the Beatles album where they, you know, misprinted the picture wrong on the cover or whatever, right, it is. And there's only,
and caught it 500 copies in or something. Right.
And some, yeah, of those got out to stores and they're worth a fortune. And whether that's true of photo books too, where page 55 is in, you know, it's printed with orange ink instead of black.
I would say, Andy, speaking for myself, I would rather people want my book for the content of the book, not because of some misprint that makes it kind of an anomaly, like a novelty.
Yeah. 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 I also think that there's a certain level of, this probably is only true of books that somehow become important anyway. And, oh, there's this odd version of it, so that's even doubly important. Mm-hmm. Right. I don't think if I made a book that had a misprint in, anybody would care.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
so yeah, I think if I, you know, misspelled something and I hope I didn't, but if I did, people aren't going to buy the book and go, oh, I'm going to hold on to this one.
Yeah, like if you were self-publishing in a way that you didn't do a full run of books but had them, you know, print to order or whatever.
Right.
And the first 100 of them had a weird thing because you missed a big obvious typo. Like you spelled your name with, you know, R-E-Y or...
Right, or G-E-O-F-F. That's not me.
Wait a second.
Hold on a second. Who's this knucklehead?
No, you're like, see, it's perfect. Fielding picks up. She goes, I think you missed something.
Right. Honey. Damn it. How many went out? 4,200. Yeah.
That's an interesting idea, but I don't know that it actually applies here.
Yeah. I would be curious to see what Ted has to say, because he's much more dialed into kind of the academic and the museum community, having been in that world for several years.
Sure.
I wonder if there's any different way of looking at it from his point of view.
Right. I'm sure that there is.
So chime in, Ted.
Yeah.
Podcast@ontakingpictures.com.
Hey, pretty cool that we got listed on that AustralianPhotography.com.
That was pretty good. Yeah, pretty good. Australian Photography said somebody actually said several of those shows aren't even being updated anymore.
Yeah, I saw that. I also found it interesting, though, that I was surprised and, you know, happy about the fact, but that they noticed it wasn't just, oh, these guys, they do a show, you should watch that show. It was, hey, they've done 177 shows, and it, you know, the fact that they actually probably listened to us, or at least looked up the amount of shows we had put out.
So thank you very much, Australian Photography.
Yeah. I'll put a link in the show notes.
I would go to Australia. I would have to get knocked out for the flight, though, man, because that's a long flight.
Man, you know, Conrad and I were looking at places to go for our trip. You know, we do this trip in the fall every year.
Yep.
Yeah. And we were looking at places to go, and I was like, maybe Hawaii. And then we were like, it's a 14-hour flight. I was like, that's, might as well go to Japan, or somewhere over there. If I'm flying that far, might as well go all the way, you know. Eight photography podcasts you should be listening right now. What else is on this list? This Week in Photo, Art of Photography, Ted Forbes, Project Rawcast. I don't know that I ever heard.
I don't know that one.
This one called On Taking Pictures, Martin Bailey's show.
Martin Bailey. I like Martin Bailey. He's been doing that show for a long time.
Photography Roundtable, Candid.fm, and Photography Business and Marketing Podcast. Interesting. I haven't heard some of these.
Candid.fm is there, but not the Candid Frame?
Yeah.
How did I miss that?
That's exactly.
Well, I would add the Candid Frame to that list.
Exactly what I was about to say.
Barrio Next Pirello.
Friend of the show, friend of ours.
Terrific guy.
Good guy.
Yeah.
But you know what? He probably has twice the listeners that we have, so.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Well, not really the point.
But he's got that voice.
He does.
Oh, he gets me.
Barrio Next has a great voice. He's using that Shure SM7.
Yeah.
And he's down. He's got that register, man.
Yeah, he's a It's all chest. It's good.
Yeah. Yeah. He's
good. What you want to go to the group and keep this one light today?
Yes. I've got a passport appointment today.
You don't have a passport?
I have an expired passport.
Where are you going with the passport?
Paris.
Ooh, when are you going to Paris?
November 27th.
You better get on that. It can take 6 weeks to get your passport.
4 to 6 weeks. It's fine. I've talked to the State Department. They said it was fine.
Yeah. Did you get Rex on the phone?
Listen,
Tillerson. I need this thing ASAP.
I know you've got some things, but yeah. Look. No, we're very excited. We have sort of a plan, very, very excited. It's the first time both Fielding and I will have gone to Paris.
Wait, you've never been to Paris?
No, I've never been to Paris.
Oh, it's good. It's fun.
Never been to Paris. I've only ever been to, in Europe anyway, I've only ever been to Florence.
Oh, then you definitely need to go to Paris.
So we're very excited. So I've got to go get my passport. I've got my DS-11 form all ready to go.
All right. Well, let's get you your thing. Let's go to the group. Let's look at assignments.
Electric.
It's electric. Do you know how to do the electric slide?
I do not. And I'm very proud of that.
Okay. I don't think I ever learned how to do that. Man, that Photorama shot by Rasmus. Ooh, that's good stuff. Look at that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good.
Through I like the that water. A lot.
Mike Kukovica. You know what? I used to have one of those Electro 35s. I would love to have one again. That one looks like it's in terrific shape. Yeah, I love those.
So what is the idea that the shutter was electronically controlled? Transistorized electronic shutter.
Was it a Copal shutter? Is that what they called that?
Copal shutter, yeah.
I think so.
Is that what it is in that camera?
I can't remember. It's got a little 40-something millimeter lens on it. Cute little cameras. It's like a
Canonette kind of thing, right?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, look at that. Solid Millie, camera, consumer.
I like that electric. Back in my hometown for the week, and I bet they are glad to have you, Millie.
It's a electronic leaf shutter, apparently.
Adam Binslev, what could be more electric than Patti Smith? Wow, I bet that was a terrific show, man. Ah, oh, that would be a nice show to see.
Rural Denmark, nice. Oh yeah, Millie's shot is beautiful. Look at that one.
Isn't that great?
Yep, real good.
Then we go into Saturday. So not a lot of electric shots today.
But a lot more Saturdays than last week. People put them up late.
That's all right. Keep them coming. Good work as always.
Yeah.
You know what? Let's any just photo sharing? Let's switch topics.
Switch gears.
Arena roadside joint is remodeling, so they just kind of moved all the stuff out onto the lawn.
Yeah, it happens.
Funny. I like that.
I want to go to Frankie B's Billiard Sports Bar.
Right,
look at that place.
I know. Tom Deards, what a cool looking dog. When Jaffa came to visit,
when what Jaffa a cool came looking to town, dog.
Look at that thing.
It's like a Johnny Cash song.
Like a golden doodle, but chocolate brown.
Yeah, it's a snickerdoodle.
What?
No, I'm just kidding. It's a labradoodle, probably.
Okay. Cute looking.
I call all those dogs snickerdoodles.
I see that. Yeah. Walk This Way, Barry. Nice.
Yep.
Rick Preston, welcome back, Rick. Have missed you. Bus shelter, Northwest Portland. How are you, Rick? I hope you're doing well.
Look at John Jennings' picture of the Florida mountains in New Mexico. That is a gorgeous picture.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Really nice.
So, yeah. I love the light of the desert, man.
People making good work.
Yep. Good stuff.
We're pro people making good work.
I like Hugh's picture of that feather. That's really cool.
Yeah. How did he do that? Is it sitting on glass?
Because he's got the mad wicked skills. That's how he did it.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So I was thinking today, elusive. You all right with elusive?
I am. Mike Kukovica visited Frank's coffee shop in Brooklyn. In Burbank. Glad you had a good time. It's a terrific place. Look at that shot behind the counter there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, look at Matthew Stodden's picture Wait. Of that Kodak Instamatic. I used, my grandmother had one of those.
Oh, yeah. 60s. Weird. Little Kodak. Ah, nice find, Matthew. Nice find.
Pretty.
All right. What do you want? What are you talking to me about? What are you doing?
I was saying hashtag elusive.
Elusive. I don't know if I can find one for that. You're all weak. Tip your wits.
Damn good. Elusive. Damn good.
Elusive.
Are you going right. to keep saying it with like really kind of cool?
Elusive. I'm trying to get that Ibarra neck. Elusive. I can't get down that low.
No.
Elusive.
He has a thing that you don't have, I don't have.
Elusive.
No, it's cute that you're trying. It's real cute.
I can't do it, Ibarra Next. I can't. I'm a pale comparison to Ibarra Next Perillo.
Photographer of the week this week.
What do you got?
Marvin Newman.
Any relation to Arnold?
No. And I met this man because he once.
And did you say, hello, Newman?
Hello, Newman. I did not because, you know. Not a big Seinfeld fan.
What?
I don't know.
This concludes my run on the On Taking Pictures program.
No. I actually find Seinfeld very funny. I just never... It's like comedy stuff, man. I just never choose to watch it. It's weird.
It's because you're not very funny.
Yeah, probably. Marvin Newman is a photographer. Been around for a long time. He was born in 27, so he's still alive. Been around for years. I saw him speak at PAI, which is this photo group here in New York City that I spoke at years ago.
How old of a fellow is he? Older fellow?
Well, he's 1927, he was born in. So you know, what does that make him? It makes him 80-something years old. No, 90 years old? 90 years old, I guess it would be, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Far as I know, you know, still alive and kicking. I haven't seen
represented
him in a
few years. The Greenberg Gallery. Nice.
Yes. Okay, so... Marvin is like, there's a lot of amazing street work that is the kind of stuff that you like. It's definitely of the era that you love. Look at this picture on the Time Magazine thing of the elephants coming through on the street. He's very well known for some of these Kodachrome shots on the street with these crazy colors. Look at, can you,
these shots on the Greenberg Gallery are phenomenal.
Yeah. He's absolutely amazing. There's a shot of Wall Street from the rafters looking down on the trading floor. That is a lot like the what's the picture of the Ali fight ring by what's his name, you know, from above.
Jesus, what's his name? Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. Neil Leifer.
Yeah, thank you. It's very much like that. And then there's that next picture where it's this guy standing in front of a big yellow wall. It says photos while you wait. And these guys, it's absolutely beautiful.
You know, I love this kind of stuff. This hits me right. Look at the Showgirls, Vegas, 1954.
Yeah.
Look at that.
Yeah. Don't you have Showgirls in your family?
different show. Oh, yes. Okay. Yes.
I just think that his work is, you know, he's another one of these guys who was around shooting all this stuff for years, decades, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That sort of, in some ways, even though he was doing work for Sports Illustrated, Life, Look, Newsweek, Smithsonian, I mean, he studied under Harry Callahan and Aaron Susskind.
God, this stuff is so good.
Yeah, he's one of the monsters. But he is not as well known as some of those other guys. And I think that is crazy because he's amazing.
I wonder what his prints go for. Well, because he's not as well known.
I don't know. They're at, Greenberg isn't messing around. So
can you call Greenberg and just go, hey, what would it cost me to get into a Marvin Newman print?
Oh, yeah.
And they'll tell you?
That's kind of what they do.
Right. Well, I didn't know if you had to like go there in person. Like, what?
I think you could certainly call. Look at the Pinterest link. Do you see that one? Where there's a whole bunch of pictures. Look at the shot of Yankee Stadium from like up in the rafters. Do you see that
first
picture?
One?
Yeah.
I mean, that looks like a scene out of The Natural.
Yeah. Right. Like just unbelievably amazing stuff.
Probably my favorite baseball movie ever. Sorry, Bull Durham fans.
Very, very good movie. Also, scroll down to the bottom of that Pinterest page, Jeffrey. Yeah. Look at the pictures of like the men in shadows with just like a tiny stream of light on them. You know, like,
oh yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, he also, interestingly enough, a little personal piece of trivia. There was a picture that Marvin Newman took of a boxing match where he was shooting, I don't know, Kodachrome 25 or something, and shot the guy. So the guy's glove, the boxer's red glove, was like smeared through the frame.
You have a picture? You have a shot?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if it's here anywhere. It took me a long time to find a version of it.
Well, then it only makes sense that you didn't save it.
Well, I did save it in one of my folders somewhere, but I didn't find it for this thing. And the
damn
point,
Bill, you had one job.
Yeah, I'll find it. The point of this story is that it was because of that blurred thing that I ended up doing my motion stuff.
Hmm.
Because of that particular picture. Oh, here's one that will do the job here. How do I get to Skype?
You got it in Skype?
Yeah, I'm going to put it in Skype. Hold on.
I also pasted in the evolution of Picasso's portraits for you.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Oh, yeah, look at that.
So you can see where I kind of found that and went, oh, yeah, look, that's interesting. I wonder if you did that in a more controlled setting, mm-hmm. what it would look like. And so, therefore, this guy has a lot of,
beautiful work. Good choice.
Lovely, lovely work. And very, very sweet man. So anyway, go check out Marvin Newman.
You should try and shoot a portrait of him before he...
Yeah, I should actually. I'll make a note of that.
Place.
You know who would know how to get a hold of him would be our friend Randy Duchesne.
Randy Duchesne. I was just thinking that. He's probably having coffee with Randy Duchesne right now. That guy knows everybody.
Funny thing is, he does.
Yeah.
I wish I knew everybody.
Well, you know of everybody, so that's kind of the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, also one last thing. Look at this Marvin
this
Newman.
BJP link is great too.
Look at this Marvin Newman self-portrait. I put in the
Nice.
You know, this black and white contrasty shot.
Yeah.
Let me put
that in the show notes.
Yeah, I'll put the Getty in.
Yeah, the British Journal of Photography link has got some more terrific pictures, some night shots. Good stuff.
Yep. So go check that out. If you want to get a hold of us, 347-687-9411, you can leave us a nice little voicemail. You can
make sure it's a nice one.
Yeah, don't be mean. Agnes, my niece, always says that. I'd be like, stop being a schmoo. She's like, you shouldn't say that. That's mean. You apologize.
You should apologize, mister.
And podcast at ontakingpictures.com will send an email to both Jeffrey and I, at Jeffrey Sidoris, at Bill Wadman, at Wadman365 on Instagram, and
Love
the
it.
Names on Twitter. And
Love
that's it, I think, right?
That's it.
You should go get your passport.
I'm going to go get my passport. 11:45 is when my appointment is.
Jeffrey, get out of the country.
Get out of here, you. Go eat some croissants and...
Croissant.
Whatever. Mm,
so good.
Yeah.
So good.
All right. We will see you next week. I am off to Maine for a couple days.
All right. Have fun in Maine.
Yeah.
And don't get too cold up there.
No. I'm looking forward to actually a little bit of a chill. It's been hot and humid here for a while.
Yeah. Then we will... you'll be back next week?
Yep. Absolutely. Okay.
Have fun, everyone. We'll see you. I guess it's almost the end of the summer. This is the end of the summer show next week.
Right.
So fast.
If you look at the eclipse, be careful.
Don't look at it with your eyes.
Right. Look, like put some glasses on, those special glasses, or I guess you could do like the pinhole thing. Is that safe? I don't know.
No,
I don't know. Don't do that. Don't do that because I don't know.
You
go
do
watch
the pinhole
NASA
onto
TV.
A card and look at the card, I think. You know what I mean? The whole
right.
Life.
That's what I meant. That's what I meant. Go talk to, you know, look on NASA, they'll stream it, then you can watch Total Eclipse of the Heart. That'll be good. There he goes.
All right, we'll talk to you later. Bye.
Have a great week. Thank you for listening, everyone.
Going on and on the way we are for so long. To any fool, it's plain to see something's wrong. This way, say what you wanna say, though I know your words will end. the way I have for too long. It's clear to me the way you see me is wrong. As this way, say what you wanna say. I know what you will say. Will leave me out. But I-